There's a huge quake on the San Andreas Fault in Southern California every 100 years or so. We haven't had one for about 160. The last time one struck, there was no Union Station. No Hollywood, no freeways to destroy or skyscrapers to crumble, no fifth largest economy in the world to cripple. We don't know when the big one's gonna hit. It could be in a year, it could be a week, or literally any minute now. But we do know that when it does, you'll have an overwhelming feeling that Mother Nature doesn't care, that you're small. The question is, how are we going to survive?
We are myopic. We say this event will not happen to me.
I can't worry about it.
Do you think about it?
About what?
About earthquake?
You realize that you are very small on this earth.
Yeah, all the time. I think about really how not prepared I am.
Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. What you just heard was an excerpt from episode one titled The Earthquake from a new podcast, The Big One, from host Jacob Margolis and producer Misha Youssef. Margolis and Youssef's podcast from NPR affiliate KPCC in Pasadena is designed to engage the listener in a scientifically accurate portrayal of what will happen when Southern California is eventually hit by a big earthquake that scientists have determined will strike the southern section of the San Andreas Fault in the near future. It may be a cliche, but it is accurate to say that it's a matter of when and not if the Los Angeles area will become the epicenter, if not seismically, certainly socially and economically, of a disaster of epic proportions. Our seismology consultant, Ken Hudnut, science advisor for risk reduction for the United States Geological Survey, joined me as we engaged the host of the Big One podcast, Jacob Margolis, via Skype from Pasadena. Jacob Margolis and Ken Hudnut, welcome to Blue Dot.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Jacob, tell us about the genesis of the Big One podcast. What was it that led you to be interested in doing a podcast to prepare Southern Californians for the large earthquake that is most assuredly to come?
Yeah, so my entire life, I've been hearing about a big earthquake. I lived through the Northridge quake in 1994. You know, from the time we're in, I'm sure, preschool, in elementary school, we hear about these quakes and what we need to do to prepare. And so as a science reporter, I'd also covered them a bit. And so what happened was KPCC is really pushing forward a podcast initiative, and they were taking pitches. And so I went in and I talked a little bit about what I cover. I cover space, I talk about some climate change, and cover earthquakes. And the podcast team was particularly interested in the earthquakes because they were like, okay, well, what can we expect here in Southern California? I'm like, oh, you know, like a quake could come and just completely cripple the region. You know, 10 to 20 million people could be impacted, and it could be a major bummer. But, you know, everybody knows about that. And they were like, actually, not everybody knows about that. And so we kind of dove in and started to break that down a little bit, what that could potentially be like, what that monster humongous quake could be, what it could mean coming from the San Andreas, what it could mean coming from some other faults in the area, or another large quake coming from some faults in the area. And over time, we decided that we wanted to, you know, share this information with people so that they knew what they were going to get into or what they could be in for living here in Southern California. And that's why with the podcast, we take there's a very strong emphasis on not only presenting this very scary information, but also trying to help get people ready. And so that was a very deliberate genesis just from us and like initially talking about, okay, this thing that probably not a lot of people actually know a whole lot about, it turned out, to, okay, now that we've terrified everyone, what are we going to do with that rapt audience? And the hope is that, you know, people walk away more prepared. So that was kind of the genesis of it. And we decided to create I've called it a Dungeons and Dragons style narrative for people to hold on to, because just presenting the information as facts, it is difficult for people to process all that information applied to their own lives. So in the story, we have a hero, and the hero goes through a journey and has to basically make their way across Los Angeles. And along the way, they see a series of things happening. And we hope that people could also better understand just the extent of the damage if they got to hear that story.
And I'm wondering about your outreach to the scientific community, to people like Ken, because I know you have the fabulous Lucy Jones on there. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I've spent a lot of time talking to different folks in the community. It started off with Lucy Jones, a famed seismologist, because we pulled a lot from the report that she helmed, the shakeout scenario. And we spent probably a total of 6 hours just talking to her, just to kind of lay stuff out, as well as fact checking and whatnot. In addition to that, you know, we went out to the fault with Morgan Page, who works for USGS. We also hung out a little bit with Kate Scherer, who is a paleoseismologist, right, Ken? I'm pretty sure she's a paleoseismologist. So she helps date when different things happen on the fault, so different earthquakes and stuff like that. And then I also reached out to folks that have been in the scientific community for ages. Lynn Sykes, who was one of the people to identify seafloor spreading, which helped us understand plate tectonics better, and all this. You know, I talked to Tanya Atwater, who was basically at the forefront, in my opinion, of what our eventual understanding of how kind of the Western U.S. in particular came to be. And really, we dove deep into that whole group of people that have been around and have affected our understanding of how the world came to be. You know, we also talked to Carrie C., who started the field of paleoseismology and who really was the first person, and Ken, please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe he's the first person to really go, hey, look, here are earthquakes that have been happening for thousands of years on this fault. You know, we should be concerned about this, a potential big one coming from here.
Yeah, I just really enjoyed the episode of your podcast called The Science, and the interviews with Tanya Atwater and Carrie C. I thought were fantastic.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, it was fun. For that episode too, we got to learn a bit about Alfred. I don't know if, Ken, you're rolling your eyes right now, but I think his story is kind of romantic, and that's how we started the episode. And he's this...
I really like how you covered that. You know, just made it really come alive for people, you know, just the whole notion of tying in exploration and scientific discovery and, you know, the polar bear part of that story. So I just, I think part of the challenge that we face in trying to make people more alert about the earthquake threat and do something about it themselves is just, you know, how do you reach people that have never gotten that message before and never gotten their earthquake kit together? How do you get to them? And it's through storytelling. We keep being told this, you know, we need to get better at that as scientists. And so how you've done it is novel. And I think if you manage through this to reach people that had not been motivated previously, then I think that's a big win. And that's what we need. We need to figure this out, how to reach people that are resistant to the message of resilience.
I wish that I like the fact that you referred to Alfred Wegener as a badass, and I wish that that's how he was referred to in high school earth science texts.
So I'm obsessed with science. I'm obsessed with the getting to sit down and read the shakeout scenario, getting to read Lynn Sykes' paper that came out in the 1960s that furthered our understanding of plate tectonics. Like, I love that stuff, but I do understand as a science reporter that it really is, it's, you have to figure out, what is the sort of sexy way to communicate that to people and also give them this kind of really important stuff? And that's what we were really worried about, was that we were going too heavy on science at certain points. And that's something I feel self-conscious about as a science reporter sometimes, because I do love that stuff so much. But I think we did strike a decent balance here. And some of the highest compliments are when the scientific community here, which I think a fair number listen to KPCC, especially at Caltech and, you know, JPL and those places. I have not been dragged by any of them yet. And that makes me really happy. So yeah. I just hope I do all their hard work as well justice, because they've worked, many lives have been spent, you know, a long time has been spent working on this stuff.
Well, it caught my attention when I especially the science episode, but all of them. I'm on my treadmill and I'm listening to it, and I know what's coming next. It's, oh, he's going to talk to Carrie C., I bet. And, oh, there he is. I was like, this is outstanding seismic science presented in a really entertaining way. Could you tell us a bit about the team that works with you? Because this sounds like this is not something that you could do by yourself.
No, 100% a major team effort. I tended to spearhead a lot of the science research. I wrote large parts of this, but I also have a team that I worked very closely with. The sound design, which is, I think, one of the most powerful parts of this whole podcast, is largely Arwen Nix, Arwen Champion Nix, who is our executive producer. Misha Youssef is our lead producer, and she did a ton of work as well and helmed some episodes. And I could keep going. I mean, it's a small core team of people that worked on it for a decent period of time, but it was definitely a team effort, and it takes a lot. And that's why it's great when people donate to public radio, because then we can do major projects like this.
I really like the texture of the sound, all of the rumblings, and it makes it really pop and come alive for the listener.
Yeah, I love that too. And that was, like I said, that was really Arwen, as well as Sean Corey Campbell and Valentina Rivera.
I also really like the feature of, at the end of each episode, you have anywhere from 3 to 5 or so tips. And I just really like the way that comes through as, and here's what you can do about it.
Yeah, when we were just going through all of these scenarios and interviewing all these companies and government agencies about what their reaction to a big earthquake would be, you know, we were living in this death and destruction and disaster and very just negative place with all of it, because it's a really heavy thing to carry, especially when you first start to realize just how bad it could possibly be. And eventually you kind of become a little jaded, but really when you're It left us in a place of feeling like, okay, we need to give people actual actionable things to do. And that's, I'm not always a huge fan of news you can use coverage. I think sometimes it can be hokey, but for something this major that impacts people's lives so much, we felt like that was really important. And Misha Youssef, like I said, the lead producer, did a really good job with the tips on this one.
Well, from listening to Lucy Jones and Ken and our friendship over the years, you know, one of the big takeaways for me about what will happen in either Southern California or in the East Bay in the case of the Hayward Fault, or in the Northwest with the Cascadia Fault, wherever we're talking about here, you are, as a listener to the podcast, if you're in Southern California or any of those other places I mentioned, and they all apply to this podcast, whether you're in Southern California or the Bay Area or Portland, is that you are likely to survive this. It is highly unlikely that you will be killed. In fact, you know, it's more likely in Southern California you'll get killed in a car wreck or murdered. The aftermath of this is what is going to make life a complete and total nightmare for a lot of people. And financially, you know, it can ruin people. So, and that's the big takeaway for me. We in Northern California, we've just experienced, to me, what's the worst natural disaster mostly natural disaster since the 1906 earthquake in San Francisco. And that was the Camp Fire that destroyed my hometown of Paradise, California. And seeing what people are going through in the aftermath of that, you know, I'm very thankful I don't live there anymore, but I've been there since it. And in that place, it's going to be decades before it recovers, if it ever does.
Yeah, it's really scary. Honestly, that's the scariest. At first, to me, and I think to most people, the scariest part is you think about the shaking and you think about what it's going to be like if you have something over your bed, say. Like, obviously, that's a bad thing. Anything heavy, especially, that could fall off, or anything that could fall off the wall. So you really think about the shaking initially. And then what we wanted to do with this, and the reason we started with the shaking, is because we wanted to move past that fairly quickly. Because for us, the most concerning things that we saw when we did a lot of research and talked to a lot of folks was that the systems that we assume will be there very might well not be, at least for a period of time. And so we want to make sure that people understand that so that they can then go ahead and get ready. And so for me personally, I went through that process, and my goal is 2 to 3 weeks being able to basically hunker down at our house and feel comfortable. That means water, that means food, that means some sort of shelter in case our house, which I think it'll be okay, but in case something does happen to our house and it's uninhabitable. And so curious what Ken thinks. How have you guys communicated to people that it's not the shaking, only the shaking, that it's actually everything afterwards? Because it felt like it's a lot for people to bridge that gap in their minds.
Yeah, the Northridge earthquake taught us scientists, and some of us really took it to heart. There's so much more to our jobs than just doing the factual part of, you know, here's the location, here's the magnitude, here's details of what happened. And so what we've come to realize is that, you know, that there's this bigger part of the problem that needs to be solved as well, which is how do you communicate effectively with everyone, meaning the whole public, because we're all in this, you know, how do we get that word out? And an awful lot of people essentially are in denial. And that through time since the Northridge earthquake, it's now been more than 25 years. A lot of people have moved into the area since then or have been born since then. And so they really can't relate to what we went through, whether it was the 89 Loma Prieta earthquake in the Bay Area or the 94 Northridge earthquake here in LA. Just the fact is an awful lot of the people that live in our big cities now did not experience strong shaking. They didn't get violently shaken by the lapels and kind of woken up to just this really nasty threat. And so people that did go through it, especially people like your family right there in Northridge, you just don't ever forget that. And it's a traumatic experience, absolutely. It's kind of like as traumatic as nearly being killed in a car crash. This is just not something you're going to ever forget. And so how people process that. I heard people when I was up after the South Napa earthquake, I'd be sitting alone in a restaurant and even long after the earthquake, people were still just talking about it and processing it. And so this is something way beyond just doing the nerdy part of the science. And so this is something beyond writing papers for journals. This is something much more important.
And I think that's something that was very impressive with the shakeout scenario that came out in 2008 that is over 300 pages long, and it's all about the impact of this big event. And because it really did take it out of just the shaking, just the science, and it really took it to the implications of it all. And for me, I think a lot about after the fires, I think about after big hurricanes, I think about, you know, the government response and whether people will be able to get the money from insurance or from FEMA. And I've then used all that in my own life to frame, how do I want to be comfortable? How do I want to survive this event? And then I take that and I go, okay, so how can this knowledge also apply to other people? A lot of people don't live in houses. They live in apartments and condos and townhouses, especially here in Los Angeles. How can we help this apply to them? If they have to live in a park for a week, is there an alternate plan that maybe they won't, so they don't have to live in a park? Maybe they have family members they can go to. Will they be able to escape the area? You know, we asked all those questions and we tried to answer a lot of them because we also realized that no two people are going to have the exact same experience. And I think that's also what people need to realize about this podcast, is that it is only one scenario. It's from a certain perspective. And that was very deliberate. Would we choose a different perspective next time? Yeah, I guess if we did a season two, we would. But we hope that this would apply to enough people and give people enough answers that they'd be able to go, all right, I know I need enough water. I know I need enough cans and that kind of stuff. And I know how I'm going to be kind of comfortable while the systems reestablish themselves.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. When we come back, Ken Hudnut and I will continue our conversation with Jacob Margolis. He's the host of the Big One podcast, an audio examination of the big earthquake scientists are certain will strike the Southern California area due to a major rupture of the San Andreas Fault. Stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's resume our conversation with Ken Hudnut from the United States Geological Survey as we visit with Jacob Margolis, host and creator of the Big One podcast. You mentioned, Jacob, about being prepared and everything. One of the, and how people process this. And I was thinking about the concept of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and how people can go through just all kinds of difficulties after an event like this for years. And I also, when I was listening last night, I thought to myself, you know, there's another kind of P in PTSD. There's a little bit of pre-traumatic stress disorder. You know, as you're listening to this, I hope people are, you know, not getting too freaked out about what's going to happen. And actually, you know, listening to those tips at the end and being proactive and doing things, you know, because when you do stuff, that helps you cope with life's big problems. And the big one is one of the biggest ones they'll ever be thrown. My favorite tip I ever got from Ken, which I pass along to everyone, and I did to my kids during the big fire up here, was always keep your gas tank full.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I have to say, like, I don't know how Ken feels, but living in the space, living in the disaster space, especially as a science reporter, can be really tough. And I know that different team members went through different, honestly, probably levels of depression at different points, like living with this idea that, you know, that something so bad is going to happen, and that wasn't necessarily even enough to get everyone motivated to go get ready. This seems like such a big task, and that I include myself in that. And so one of the things that we did try to tackle with this was motivate people. And it's really hard to motivate people for an event that hasn't happened in their lifetimes, for something they haven't lived through. It's hard to motivate people for an event that doesn't have a due date, that we don't know when it's going to hit. And so we actually talk a bit about that, about the psychology behind it, in episode 8. And in episode 7, I try to get ready. And I failed for a long time in getting ready, because part of me, I was just, I think part of it was, I'm a procrastinator sometimes. And part of it was this feeling, I didn't want to fail my family. I have a new baby, you know, I want him to be safe. I want my wife to be safe. And it was this fear that it wouldn't, no matter what we did, wouldn't be enough. And eventually where I came back to was, okay, well, we need to do just enough to at least be comfortable for a period of time. And I think the thing that people that should prepare, that haven't prepared, need to tell themselves is, like, they should just go ahead and do it little piece by piece at a time, because it's also very expensive. It's a big psychological thing to take on. And we have a lot going on in our lives besides this. And that's a real honest thing. And then after the earthquake, you know, is a whole other story, right? I have a cousin that lives in Mexico City, and we talked to her in episode 8 as well, that never understood why people ran outside of their buildings when the earthquake alarms there went off, and they would cry and have a really difficult time. She understood it logically. She didn't understand it, like, emotionally, because she wasn't there in 85 when the 85 quake hit and people, tons of people died. Then in 2017, she was there when, on the anniversary of the 85 quake, another big quake hit, and a lot of people died. Buildings collapsed. I believe she went by some buildings and could, like, smell bodies. And that's really dark, and that's sad, and that's difficult to deal with. And now every time the earthquake alarm goes off, she said to me, she is out right away. And we're not taught that in California, and she grew up here, you know, get under your desk and be safe. But in Mexico City, it's a little different. And so I think people do carry those scars with them for a long time. And there is a lot of processing that needs to go on. My cousin's been going to therapy. I definitely talked to my wife about all the preparation and me being worried about the family and all that stuff too. But there is really heavy stuff that comes along with this, and of thinking of your own mortality and your space on Earth, and the fact that, and I say this in the podcast, that Mother Nature doesn't care. It's going to do what it's going to do. But is there just a little thing you can do to help yourself? And that's kind of where I hope people end up by the end of this podcast.
How many episodes are there, Jacob?
9.
And where are we at right now, on episode 5?
Episode 5 comes out this week, and that's about economics and also racial disparity when it comes to recovery. It's a big part of that episode. And episode 6 is all about some giant buildings that we haven't really addressed here in Los Angeles that could very well suffer in a major quake, possibly be unusable, possibly collapse. And then 7 is prepping, 8 is the psychology of why we don't, and 9 is wrapping it all up. Hmm.
Ken, could you address where we're at with the early warning system, the shake alert that might be available for people to use that live in Southern California or the Bay Area or any, you know, earthquake-prone area, where they can get that early warning that a P-wave arrival has happened, and then, you know, get ready for strong shaking?
Sure. The USGS led Shake Alert Earthquake Early Warning Project is coming along nicely. One of my colleagues here in the Pasadena office, Doug Given, has been leading that for a number of years. And here in Southern California, we're fortunate to be joined in that development effort by California Institute of Technology. There's a really great group that's been working hard on that for many years. And some of the original thought leaders, Tom Heaton, Hiro Kanemori, are available to, you know, work with the whole team and inspire them through their work, through their efforts. And I know I've been personally inspired by them over the years. Just, you know, some of the original innovators of the very idea. Now, of course, it goes way back. The idea that people could be alerted before the strong shaking hits, actually to the early days of the use of the telegraph. So the thought of outpacing the seismic energy is not an entirely new thought, but the idea of making it work operationally is very challenging, especially here in California. So in some other countries, Mexico, Japan, the geometry of the faulting is such that out on the coast, you have the source of the big earthquake, and then far away, you have the cities. In Mexico City's case, it's to the northeast of the subduction zone. And so there you have a little bit of distance, and you therefore get an advantage in that speed race between the detection of the shaking close to the source of it and where the shaking is going to be felt and where it's going to be damaging. And so I'm generalizing a bit to just move quickly through describing it. But here in California, our problem is that the San Andreas Fault goes right on down through the on-land portion. And instead of being off to the side such that you get that time advantage, here in some cases, like the Northridge earthquake of 94, the San Fernando Valley was right on top of that earthquake. So there would be no way to have that time separation. It's kind of like lightning thunder, where if you're so close to the lightning that, you know, you see it's flash, boom, there's no time separation. Northridge earthquake would have been like that, kind of flash, boom. If you have an earthquake that's bigger and starts farther away from LA, like in the Big One podcast series, the 7.8 starts out near the Salton Sea, ruptures towards Los Angeles, then you have a time separation, and it's more like flash, tick, 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 and then later, boom. And in your podcast, you nicely work with Lucy Jones to describe the time progression of it. But Los Angeles, Mayor Garcetti speaks in your podcast series as well. You know, City of Los Angeles has also invested nearly $5 million of their skin is in this game of being able to do earthquake early warning, because a big one on the San Andreas, if it starts down there, you know, you really could have 45 seconds, maybe longer, of warning time before the damaging S waves arrive. So that's what we're trying to accomplish. It's really difficult. This has been a long-term, multi-year investment of really serious thought, innovation, and a kind of a mixing of the operational aspects of running a seismic network, getting the data back quickly, upgrading all the sensors and all of the data loggers and components of the telemetry to make it as best we can with the resources available, and also turning it into not just the technical aspect of here's the alert, but also letting people know, and here's what you want to do with it now that you know that the shaking is about to hit. So it's all built together, the whole emphasis on shakeout with the drop cover hold on, letting school kids know this is what you need to do is when you get that alert, drop cover hold on, get safe. And we're trying to give people extra time for that heads up and to be able to take protective action.
I think one of the coolest things that you guys are also doing and that could potentially happen with the system is that trains could also come to a stop, which they've implemented in Japan. And you have at least maybe a couple seconds for like surgeons to pull their instruments out of a patient or something like that. Like those things to me are the coolest, or some of the coolest things that you'll be able to do.
So here's my question is, I would like to know how you came up with the idea of telling this story through this fictional character. You call him the hero, and I'm not sure that I've ever heard he has a name, but we also hear about his family. I believe it was his wife's name, Layla, and then he has a child, Omar.
Yep.
Could you tell us about, like, you know, is this somewhat autobiographical where you're dealing with, like, kind of projecting your own family onto this fictional character? Where, what, how did you come up with this idea for this is how to tell this story? Because it makes it very compelling.
Yeah, thank you so much. We came up with the idea because we didn't think that just giving people a rundown of science things again and again and again was going to be that compelling for 9 episodes. And we needed to give people a story to grab onto. And we decided to choose a family. The reason we chose walking across Los Angeles was a very practical thing. It starts at Union Station, which is sort of close to the center of downtown LA. Downtown LA is going to be kind of a concerning place to be in a major earthquake. There are also some brick buildings right near Union Station that will very much suffer damage. And we then had the hero commute to downtown LA because we wanted them to have to walk back across Los Angeles. And when they do that, they have the opportunity to see kind of all these different systems that have failed in different ways. And then eventually they have to walk over mountains to North Hollywood because, you know, on the top of those mountains, you're theoretically going to be able to see the fires, the untamed fires that have been breaking out across the area. So part of it was storytelling just for kind of storytelling's sake. And a lot of it was very practical that, you know, we wanted to make sure that people had an actual narrative to sort of grab onto. When it comes to the family, we chose a family partially because it is a little autobiographical, but I have to say that a lot of the details of the family were also chosen by Misha Youssef and Arwin Champion Nix, the two producers I worked with. And the reason we put them in a house is because for us, there were a lot of actionable things that you can do when you are in a house. It's a bit more complicated if, say, you're in an apartment and you basically can say to people, like, only a few things. Like, if you're in a soft story apartment, make sure it's retrofitted because those are very dangerous in an earthquake. And if you live in a condo, it's a bit complicated because you have to figure out, you know, how to deal with all of your neighbors. And so we chose what is basically the simplest scenario where we can give very actionable advice, which is people that live in houses and have a small family, probably because of me. And I just had a baby and I'm obsessed with it. But the other stuff was definitely practical so that we could give them as much advice as possible.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. In case you're just joining us, Ken Hudnut from the USGS and I are talking to Jacob Margolis. He's the host of The Big One, a podcast about what will happen when a major earthquake on the San Andreas Fault hits Southern California. We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return to our conversation with Ken Hudnut from the United States Geological Survey and Jacob Margolis, host of The Big One, a podcast produced by KPCC in Pasadena about all the ramifications of a major earthquake that's surely going to strike Southern California in the near future. What's been like something that this experience has done for you personally, Jacob, where, you know, with your family and your young child, where something that you've done where you're like, yeah, you know, I'm going to do that. And you've done it.
Oh, my gosh. Well, in episode 2, you hear that we legitimately have zero plan. And that was 100% the truth. And then by episode 7, I was supposed to have figured it all out and solved all the problems. And that was really, really tough. And so I think it definitely, and we have this on tape, and I don't want to spoil any of it because it's some good drama. Definitely some arguments between my wife and self about how to prepare and how to make sure that we are going to be safe, that my kid's safe, because we are also separated across LA, the three of us, every single day. How are we going to come back together? If I will have to go to work, what's my family going to do? Well, it turns out they'll probably hang out with some other family members. What if their houses are ruined? Okay, where do we go then? And so it really made us put our lives under a microscope. And then we had to document that for public consumption, which is also something I'm not comfortable with. I don't love social media. I don't love doing that part, but I felt like going through that journey myself was also really valuable for the audience. And I want the audience to know that, you know, I'm there with them, and this stuff's hard and this stuff's expensive, but if I can do it, I think most of them can handle it too.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to reflect on is just, you know, in the way that you do with, at the end of each episode, you give a short list of tips. And another thing that I like that you've done is talk honestly about the extent to which any one of us is not fully prepared. I don't know very many people that feel like they're fully prepared to handle a big earthquake. It's more like we all have work to do on that.
100%.
It's sort of like this admission that, I have thought about things that I should do and I haven't done them yet. And it makes you feel bad because, like in our case, it is expensive. Not everything has to be. So I like to focus on those things that are not necessarily expensive. You know, things like just simply getting more water, and think about the value of the water that you do stash at home or in your office or in your car, and how the value of that water on a regular day is not very great. And so it's cheap, it's affordable. You can just kind of get it and put it away and not really think that much of it. It's not a big ticket item. But the value of that water, now imagine you're a day or a few days after a big earthquake. How valuable is that water? So you can make an investment that's not very great today. And you can do this on an ongoing basis every once in a while when you're going to get groceries, maybe not every single time, but just get into the habit of, when you can and you have room in your trunk to throw in a flat of water bottles, just go ahead and do it and then take them out, put them away. And I've kind of done that to the extent that our garage at home is pretty fully loaded with a lot of water. But I loved it when you were talking to Lucy and she said, basically, no matter how much water you have, get more. yeah. Right. So even I should, and I realized that. But that I don't always remember to get more.
I totally understand that. I totally understand that. It's completely overwhelming. And like we had to pull, and for us, you know, we did all this around because of the deadline for the show. We did all this around the holidays. We had to dig into savings to do a lot of this stuff. And, you know, that was a conversation I had with my wife that we were worried about that. And we did it because, one, the show, honestly, but also because, and I might have spread it out more if we weren't doing the show, but also because we knew that having that extra shelter, having those first aid things, we started from zero. So we had no Band-Aids because we moved and kind of lost a lot of stuff or tossed stuff out in the process. Having that kind of first aid stuff and everything and buying all of it, I think in all told, it was $700. And I don't think we're done. I mean, that's a lot. I don't know. It feels like a lot of money to me.
Well, one of the things I wanted to also reflect on is another low-cost thing. There was mention in one of Misha's tips there about how, you know, put your data up in the cloud if you can afford to do that. And some of those cloud options are basically free. And another thing that's almost free is just buy a USB stick. And then with your documents, you can even just with your smartphone, I realize not everybody has a smartphone, but a lot of us do. And just take pictures of important documents. You don't even need a scanner. And then just with those, get them onto a USB stick. And we did some of this in kind of a hurry up mode right before the 2009 station fire, because we did have to, on a daily basis, we were basically fully evacuated from our house every day because my wife and I would go to work and we would take our kids to school. And we had gone through the process because that fire was close to our house and kept getting closer. We had figured out, here are the family photos, you know, and we had gone about the business of getting important documents scanned, and we did it. And, you know, that was 10 years ago, I now realize, and we should do it again and update things. But once you've done that, and many people share that experience now, I think, whether it was through wildfires coming close to them or whatever, once you've done it once, then you do need to periodically update it. But just the simple idea of next time you're at Office Depot to get inkjet cartridges or whatever, just grab a USB stick and then make another copy and have it just so that you can grab and go. This is, it just seems so basic and so vital, and it could really, really be, it could save so much in the way of, I don't know, lost everything. So
100%. It's
like family photos, right? People talk about, you know, those, shoeboxes with the old, photos from back in the day before it was all digital, but with digital photos now, you want to at least be able to grab, whether it's a USB stick or maybe an external hard disk, but that's so vital, all those memories.
And, you know, it's interesting talking about this because we're focusing on the podcast, the big one, hosted by Jacob Margolis out of KPCC. And we're talking about earthquake preparedness, but this applies for anywhere you live. All of us face the reality that nature, life can throw a monkey wrench at you at the most unexpected times. So these are tips that are good for anyone wherever you're listening to this program.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was something that we also wanted to emphasize with the extra little help that we offer. There are the basics, like 1 gallon per person per day. Whether you're in an earthquake zone or you're in an area with hurricanes, you know, I'm sure there's some extra stuff. It'd probably be good to have sandbags if you were in that area versus an earthquake zone, where it's probably good if you shore up your house a bit. But having that extra food, having those extra medicines is a really big one. Insulin, we've had some people ask about insulin. You should absolutely have extra insulin if at all possible. And if it needs some sort of refrigeration, which I believe insulin does, you should probably invest in some sort of generator that can keep a small refrigerator running for a period of time. And the coolest thing that's happened out of this entire thing, and this is 100% the reason why I got into journalism and why I love science reporting, is that we've had people reach out to us with questions and with comments and tell us, hey, look, I went out, someone tweeted at me that they bought a propane generator. That's totally cool. Great. I'm glad he could afford it. And now his family's going to be that much better off if there's no power for 3 days or a week. You know, there's people that are talking about figuring out what to do with relatives with disabilities. I think that's hugely important. Having extra medical documents as well, making sure that those are accessible. Because also, when you go to FEMA and when you go to get some money or some help, you need to have some of those documents with you. And I think also, like you were saying, Ken, like just having them stored digitally is important as well. But this applies to not just earthquake people. It applies to everyone, especially with the number of natural disasters that we have all the time, like year round. Feels overwhelming at times.
I'd like to cycle back a little bit to the science, because that was the episode that I enjoyed the most, just because, you know, I'm a science guy. And a comment that you made earlier about visiting the San Andreas Fault, could you tell us a bit about what that experience was like for you? And for somebody who's never actually been in the fault zone, I know Ken and I both have, tell us what was it like for you to go visit that? And what did you learn from that experience?
Yeah, so we drove from Pasadena, which is just north of downtown Los Angeles, and we drove over to Palmdale. You go from sort of the city area and the suburbs to all of a sudden you're kind of getting out to the desert. And right when you crest the hills and you go over into Palmdale, you see this giant lake. It's Palmdale Lake, and there's a bunch of houses around it. And we're with USGS scientist Morgan Page, and we're talking about the lake and we're looking at it, and she's like, oh yeah, that's there because of the San Andreas Fault. Like the water basically, and Ken, please correct me if I'm wrong, but basically the rocks get pulverized enough that water can seep up, and they have thus like dammed off parts of it and, you know, kind of contained that. But you have all these homes around this lake that's literally the San Andreas Fault. And we get there and we decide to drive into the neighborhood and check it out and ask some people why they live there. And while it doesn't look like much from that perspective right there, it was kind of alarming to see people choose to live in that exact place. And there's a lot of developments in that exact place. And so I left that area pretty concerned. People live there because it's a little cheaper. They like living out in the desert, and it's beautiful out there. We then continued over to Devil's Punch Bowl area, further out towards, I think it's towards Lancaster. And out in the middle of the desert, out of nowhere, are trees and a stream. And that's there too because of the fault. And so it's not this giant chasm, at least the parts that we saw. You know, there's not a giant chasm, but you have these effects of the fault that you can see out in the middle of nowhere. And to me, that was awe-inspiring because, you know, we could build out here, we exist out in this space, and no matter what we do, this thing's always going to be there. You know, it'll be there even after we're all gone. And I don't think I'm being very eloquent in describing this right now, but there was this kind of feeling of awe being out there, even though it wasn't as, you know, dramatic as a Hollywood movie might lead you to believe. It still felt pretty powerful because this had been there long before we've been around, and it'll be there long after we're around, and eventually it won't be there at all.
Yeah, those places you were talking about where water collects, those are called sag ponds. And what's really interesting to do is, I don't know if you've ever tried this, but I would encourage our listeners to check it out, is just go on Google Earth, and from that satellite view, you know, follow the San Andreas Fault, and from above, it's very obvious, you know, what you're looking at, and that this really is something that you can see from space. Ken and I have shared many times, you know, photographs of when we're flying from Sacramento or the Bay Area to Southern California, you know, always get on that side of the plane where you can check out the fault at Carrizo Plain, because we love to look at it. It's so striking.
On Twitter, some of my work colleagues, we have there's a hashtag people are using, always a window seat, and a lot of the photos that you'll find from people like Rich Briggs, Tim Dawson, Kate Scherer, and others are photographs looking out the airplane window at the San Andreas Fault or other faults that we happen to be going over. Yeah, it's the San Andreas Fault. What I've enjoyed over the years is the discovery that I can give to others, and that I see it in other people's eyes when I take them to the Lamont Odette Vista overview point where you were describing having gone to see the San Andreas Fault. And, you know, you pull off there and you start arm waving and talking about, you know, the North American plate and the Pacific plates moving to the northwest. And in a big earthquake like the last one, which was in 1857, it would have moved probably about 15 feet just over there. And, you know, especially with younger students, just to see their eyes kind of lighting up as they get it. And then, you know, you start talking about how, and this lifeline infrastructure would get cut and ripped apart right there. And they're like, oh my God, it makes it real when you're right there. And, you know, people have all heard about the San Andreas Fault. It's great to share that with people.
And the thing is that none of this would be here without these geologic processes. Everything that we get to experience here in Southern California is kind of due to those. And so for us to be here at this point in time, to get to enjoy all this really awesome stuff here because of that, this also very destructive process, to me, that is so cool. That is so cool. And we're very fortunate. But, you know, we also have to approach it with a little caution because it can blow your house down.
Jacob, thank you so much for joining us. And I love the Big One podcast. I recommend it. You know, it's just fascinating to listen to. It's riveting. And it's a great way to spend 20 to 30 minutes and educate yourself about the earthquake threat that Southern California is most definitely facing. So thanks for joining us, and best of luck with the rest of the podcast.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me. And it was great to chat with both of you. Like, I absolutely love this. So it's really cool to get to chat science for so long.
As an 11-year-old kid living a block away from railroad tracks in Northridge, California, I grew used to the sound and vibrations of passing freight trains every night. I even found the experience somehow soothing and engaging as I imagined where the trains might be coming from and going to. On the morning of February 9th, 1971, I heard the train coming as usual at 6 o'clock in the morning, only this train seemed to have derailed and was coming right into my second-story bedroom. Half asleep, I was terrified to hear the sound of what I thought to be a runaway train. As I awoke, I saw the plastic World War II model airplanes suspended by fishing line over my bed, swinging and bashing into the ceiling. I also had a pool table in my bedroom, and the balls were careening off the felt-lined slate. Near dawn, it dawned on me that this wasn't the train, but what was it? My parents shouted, "Earthquake!" downstairs as my bed bounced up and down. What I most remember, though, was the sound of the earth beneath our home moving up and down from the shock of the fault rupture a few miles away in the San Gabriel Mountains. Our home was made of wood, and it flexed with the shaking. I'll never forget the sound it made, but at least the damage was minimal. Later that day, however, we learned that freeways, the I-5 and 210 overpasses, had collapsed. The main north-south route was cut off for Southern California. There was loss of life at the Veterans Hospital in Sylmar, and we watched on TV as rescuers desperately picked through the rubble. But even scarier was the Lower Van Norman Dam, just a few miles above our home. It was severely damaged, and officials from the L.A. Department of Water and Power worried that another St. Francis Dam disaster could add to the catastrophic damage and cost thousands of lives. Friends of ours, evacuated from nearby Granada Hills, just below the dam, came to stay with us until the water was safely drawn down and a secondary disaster was averted. They were terrified, as I recall, when they came to stay with us. The next night, there was a total lunar eclipse, my first experience with the weird coppery red light of all the sunrises and sunsets on Earth cast upon the moon. Just a day before, I'd watched as astronaut Alan Shepard had hit his famous six-iron shot up there that went, in his words, miles and miles. I watched the spectacle of the eclipse through my telescope from my driveway as aftershocks rippled through, further frightening all of us. And it was natural to wonder, could the eclipse have caused the earthquake? Probably not, since the temblor preceded the alignment of the moon, sun, and earth, but folks were talking about it. The aftershocks were strange. You could hear them coming, and then the house would start to groan and shake. Over the months that followed, they gradually diminished. But my interest in earthquakes was totally sparked, and I started to learn about the new theory of plate tectonics, realizing that a major plate boundary, the San Andreas Fault, was also my neighbor. Seeing the signs of surface faulting, scarps, and buckled roads near my father's house in Sunland was strangely fascinating. And I remember hearing crazy stories about the big one and California falling into the ocean. Even at 11 years old, I knew that was ridiculous. But the thought of an earthquake bigger than the 6.5 magnitude one that I had experienced was a very scary thought. Now, these decades later, I know a lot more about earthquakes and the thought of what will happen when the big one hits Southern California or the Hayward Fault in the Bay Area is truly sobering, because the old cliche is true, it's just a matter of when, not if, it will happen. Thanks again to our good friend Ken Hudnut from the United States Geological Survey and our special guest, Jacob Margolis, host and creator of the Big One podcast from NPR affiliate KPCC in Pasadena. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in Northern California. You can listen to this and past episodes at mynspr.org or subscribe to our NPR podcast via the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by PRX, also known as the Public Radio Exchange. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by Mr. Blue Sky Schofield. Our associate producer is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.